Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So we're going to talk tonight about how to be a little less awful. Not a big goal, a kind of a small goal, being a little less awful. You can work for extra credit at being a lot less awful if you'd like to. I'm not going to stop you. But for me, a little bit at a time. Here are the four things I want us to do. I'm going to talk about just what a virtue is. I'm thinking of virtues as being the ways in which we get better, get less awful. So if virtue is the goal, the thing we're aiming at to get better, we got to figure out what it is that we're aiming at. So it makes sense that we should ask first and foremost, just what is this thing called virtue that we're looking for? We'll talk also about some divisions among the virtues. You probably heard of the four cardinal virtues, maybe the three theological virtues. There's intellectual virtues too. We'll talk about all these and what divides them from one another. What makes a cardinal virtue different than a theological virtue? The third thing I want to talk about is some corroboration you find between Christian moral wisdom, like what the church fathers were teaching in the desert, what the schoolmen were saying in the medieval era, what those people were saying about habit formation and growth on the one hand, and on the other hand, contemporary psychological data about how best to habituate yourself and grow in a virtue, how to inculcate a stable disposition. We'll find, I think, strong corroboration between what was said in ages past by Christian moral wisdom and what's said now today by contemporary psychology. And then fourth and finally, and in fact the largest part of the talk, we'll be talking about how one goes about developing virtue. So there's four things listed, but you got to think of that fourth one as like 75% of what we're going to be up to today. Okay, off we go. If you want to know what a thing is, especially a theological or philosophical thing, it often helps to go look at what classical art has to say about it. Say in a sense, right? How classical art depicts the thing. So you can look at, say, justice with a blindfold on and holding scales. And you can form some concepts of what justice is supposed to be based on those topics. Like it should be impartial. That's why she wears the blindfold. It should weigh things fairly. That's why she has publicly available and seeable scales there. So maybe look at how the virtues have been depicted in art, and we can get a sense of what virtue is. So here's a famous painting, The Triumph of the Virtues. And I think we could look here. Let's see what we find. A little dubious it's going to help, though. I mean, look at, I think I understand this a bit. And I think from the left side, we get the virtues entering in. And from the right, we get the vices being beaten, being triumphed over. And if you look at what they're up to, you got the virtues bringing some babies with for the battle, and some weapons for the battle, and some babies carrying weapons for the battle. You've got, from Marvel Cinematic Universe, you've got Groot's mom over here hiding out. I don't know what any of those vices are supposed to be, or maybe I know one of them. You've got the vice of, well, you all know what this is, right? The dastardly vice of having a lady without arms who's naked on a leash. We all know what that is. Don't have to tell you what that is. We've got surfing on a centaur. You're familiar with that one. Don't do that at college. And I think this is the only one I actually get. And I think this one is supposed to be a symbol of someone who's luxurious, like a king, being intoxicated, so he has to be carried off. That one I think I'm on sure footing for. The rest of it, not so much. So if you're going to look at art, this might not be the best place to look, but I love it, so I want to show it to you guys. We'll have some art from AI and some art from actual artists in the history of the world. And this is, I just want to point out, this is a real human who made art, and this is what came out. This one is too. Both St. Augustine is a real human, and also this is art from a real human. But here's how Augustine defines virtue. If the art isn't going to help much, let's go to a Christian doctor of the church. What's he say? Well, here's what Augustine says. He says, virtue is a good quality of the soul by which we live rightly, of which no person makes bad use, which God works in us without us. So we see four parts there, the definition. We see it's a good quality of the soul, you live rightly by it, you can't make bad use of it, and God works it in us without us. Consider each of those parts for a moment. Augustine says it's a good quality of the soul. Why a quality? Well, here, think of it like this. You've got, on the one hand, your stable character traits. Maybe you're a patient person. Like, think of the most patient person you know. Grandma, maybe. Maybe she's not it. But, you know, think of the most patient person you know. She's got a stable disposition to respond patiently to dangerous or bad things. And think of the most hot-headed person you know. Maybe it's dad. You know, like, think of the person who's ready to pop off at a moment's notice. They've each got a stable disposition to act a certain way. That's what a virtue or a vice is a stable disposition. It's not just like a one-off. You know, grandma might be super angry one day and snap at you, and you might say, that was really out of character. I don't expect her to do that. That's showing us we've got an idea, one, of a stable character trait, because she's patient, and two, of this act that's outside the stable trait, because she's acting impatiently at that moment. So it's got to be a quality, not just an act. Consider the next two. He says, one, it by which you live rightly, and two, of which no one makes bad use. And here, if you stop for a bit and think about it, you might think he's just repeating himself. Like, if you say you use it to act well and you can't use it to act poorly, it kind of sounds like you're saying the same thing twice. But I think it's not true. I think he's got a real insight here that we should focus on. Think of it like this. There are some character traits that are, you might think, mixed. Sometimes through using it, you behave well. Sometimes the very same trait can lead you to behave poorly. Think about tenacity in a young child. Any of you have younger siblings? You got a younger sibling, and like the sibling destroyed the bedroom. And then her loving and patient and meek and humble and kind and generous father says, clean up this big old mess you made. And she's like, no, I'll never do it. Her tenacity there, her tenacity of refusing to clean up the very mess that she made, isn't a particularly good-making feature in a child. Fighting against I'm the rightful authority, darn it. Fighting against the rightful authority. On the other hand, tenacity can be quite helpful in some cases. Like, think if you're trying to learn something very difficult, like you're trying to learn a new language. Tenacity there could be quite beneficial for you. So some traits are mixed. Sometimes you can have it and act through it poorly, like the child who's disobeying. Sometimes you can have it and act through it well, like the person learning the language. What he's saying here is that the virtue is a thing which you act well from and you don't act poorly from. So it's not a mixed trait. Virtues are only aimed toward the good. If you have a boss one day in the future who tells you to do something that's flagrantly illegal, and you say, I'm not going to do that. And he says, be a good employee, be a team player. You got to be obedient. I'm your boss. I told you to do it. You got to do it. Remember at that point that obedience, the virtue, never calls for immoral activity. So if he's asking you to do something flagrantly illegal, he's asking you to do something contrary to the virtue of obedience. It's not obedience to do the wrong. So Augustine's point here is just that virtue, one, has a positive moral polarity, aims toward good things, and two, never has a negative moral polarity, never aims at bad things. And that final bit, that God works in us without us, that's in there in particular for theological virtues. He had in mind the man named Pelagius. Pelagius taught that you could earn your own salvation. You could earn your own gift of faith. I mean, not even gift, right? You can earn, God owes it to you because you're so doing so many good works. And Augustine wants to make it clear that, especially when it comes to the theological virtues, they aren't things that we earn. As Paul says, it's a gift, gratuitously given. And in fact, if you look really carefully here, I don't know if you can see it from where you are, but the word Pelagius is right there. He's got his foot on a book of Pelagius in this picture. So that's what virtue is. That's the definition I'll be using when I think through what a virtue is. This is an AI representation of a monk drawing a virtue tree, a tree of the different virtues. I said the second thing I wanted to do, and we're already there, guys, already at number two. The second thing I wanted to do was talk about some divisions among the virtues. You've heard of, like I said, the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues. What divides them? Well, think of it like this. The moral virtues are aimed at doing the good well. So a moral virtue aims at excellence with respect to some activity that you're doing. Intellectual virtues don't so much aim at the good and doing it well. but they aim at truth and knowing that truth. So where the moral aims at the good, the intellectual aims at the true. Finally, the theological virtues, those aim at right relation with God somehow. So what we have here then is just three different sorts of virtue, moral, intellectual, and theological. And they're divided up by what they're aimed at. And as you well know, the moral virtues further subdivide between the four cardinal virtues that I have listed up there. And even those four cardinal virtues further subdivide further. Down and down you can go, getting more and more distinctions in it. And the medievals loved distinctions because they didn't have Netflix. Like, what were they going to do at night? You know, they just threw distinctions galore. So for temperance, for instance, you could be temperate with respect to your sexual appetites, your desires for sex. And that we call chastity. You're chaste when you're temperate with respect to your sexual appetites. And you could be temperate with respect to your desires for intoxicants. And that we call sobriety. Being sober is being temperate with respect to intoxicants. And so on and so forth. So just the basic idea is, for each different type of thing you can be allured by, we can understand a virtue, which is excellence, with respect to that allurement. Okay, so that's the second thing I wanted to say, just to understand how we divide up these virtues as we understand them from Augustine. Now this, you might wonder, but yes, this is also an AI picture. I had a real hard time getting a desert monk and a research psychologist in the same room together and letting them blow a hole through the wall to get that sort of high five action there. So I just asked AI to make it for me, and it did. But what I want to talk about now is just two ways that the old teachings from Christian moral wisdom align with new findings for psychologists. We'll see more later, but this is just wetting our whistles, so to speak, getting us ready for more. The first, with respect to fasting. Now, here's something Thomas Aquinas says with respect to fasting. And again, he's quoting Augustine. And Augustine says the following. He says, quote, "Fasting cleanses the soul, it raises the mind, it subjects the flesh to the spirit, it renders the heart contrite and humble, it scatters the clouds of concupiscence, it quenches those fires of lust, and it kindles the true light of chastity." End quote. It's a lot of stuff for fasting to do, right? So one question we might have is, can we show, or do we have any evidence that fasting actually has these sorts of benefits? Not all of them surely can be tested by psychology, but some of them can. Like if you say that fasting in one area, like from food, helps with respect to curbing the clouds of concupiscence or quenching the fires of lust, that seems like a thing you might be able to study, whether fasting in one area helps with allurement from another area. Well, if you look at what psychologists say, we'll start old and we'll get to contemporary. Here's William James, a philosopher by training, one of the very first psychologists, maybe the first in America at least. What's James say? He says this. He says, quote, "Be systematically heroic in little unnecessary points. Do every day or two something for no other reason than its difficulty, so that when the hour of dire need draws nigh, it may find you not unnerved and untrained to stand the test." What's the idea here? Well, the idea here is this. Every day or so, find something difficult for you to do, like, say, withholding or abstaining from something, not eating dessert, not listening to your favorite podcast, not watching your favorite show. Find a little thing that's difficult to do and do it. And you might think, why would I do that? Why would I want to do this difficult thing just to do the difficult thing? And he's saying, it's not just to do it, like you're having a contest with yourself. You're doing it as a way of training yourself up. You're fasting from the dessert, so to speak, so that later, when you find a temptation that really, really gets you, it's really alluring you, you can have built up the muscle to say no to yourself. That's his idea here. Seems like fasting is useful, according to James. Here is, I think, one of the most premier scholars of self-control research in psychology today, Mark Moravan. And I love this picture. I'm sorry it's a little fuzzy. I couldn't find a less fuzzy one, but I just loved it because he's like the self-control guy. And look, he's sitting in front of cookies and brownies. And he's not eating a single one, is he? Like, look at his hands. There's no crumbs on those hands. That beard, crumbless beard. So he is self-controlling so hard there in that picture. I thought I just had to use it. What's he say? He says this. He says, quote, practicing small acts of self-control for 2 weeks led to a significant improvement on a laboratory measure of self-control. The present research strongly suggests that the active ingredient in building self-control capacity is the practice of self-control. End quote. How do you get more self-control? You practice at it. Like James was saying, every couple days, do a thing that's difficult. Practice at it. What's it going to do? It's going to build up your self-control. Does it matter what you're practicing? Well, psychologists have a notion of what they call transferability. And transferability is when you can build a feature in one area of your life and have it transfer to another one. So for instance, if you're really, really good at studying for, say, math, that those study habits you form for math are likely easily transferable to some other areas as well. What he says here is this. This is the bottom here. What is being practiced does not matter as long as it requires self-control. The thought is, what you're doing so much doesn't matter. Provided that you're working your self-control and building that muscle up, you'll get better at it. So, to my mind, we find in Aquinas and Augustine some clear requirements for fasting. Also, in this guy named Jesus Christ you might know of, he was pretty keen on fasting as well. And we find also in contemporary psychology some evidence support from laboratory measures that it works. Now, a warning, and this warning fit better during Lent last week than it does now, because you're probably not fasting so much right now. But here's what Aquinas says about fasting. Sometimes Catholics are prone to want to go like 110% at fasting, which can be great, but just be mindful. Here's what Aquinas says. He says, quote, it is certainly a sin for one to weaken the body's power so much with fasts and vigils and other such things that one is unable to do what one ought to do. As, for example, a preacher ought to preach, a teacher teach, a singer sing, and so on. Hence, Jerome says, one who afflicts the body with an excessive want of food or an immoderate lack of sleep offers a stolen sacrifice. I like that phrase, stolen sacrifice. I wonder, what exactly does he mean there by it? And I think the idea is this. You've got some obligations in your life, some things you're obliged to do. Preacher's got to preach well. Teacher's got to teach well. I'm a dad. I've got to dad well, or at least I tried to dad well. And if I fast so hard during Lent that I become like a way worse dad, I'm like a grumpy cave bear at my kids, grump, 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 all day long at my children, I'm screwing it up, right? I owe them an obligation. They deserve a good dad. I owe them that. And I'm stealing what's owed to them. And I'm instead offering it to God. Here, take the sleep I need to parent well. And take the food I need to not be a grumpy goose. And I give it to you, Lord. And Aquinas' thought here is, that would be a stolen sacrifice. Because it's not yours to give. It's already owed to somebody else. It's already owed to my children that I behave well for them. Now, I don't know how many of you guys have kids, but you have siblings, some of you told me earlier, and you might have parents or other sorts of guardians. And so you also owe obligations to them. I've been talking about parents owing obligations to kids a lot, but I don't know how much that affects you guys. But the other direction also counts, right? You owe your parents something too. The second one I said, remember two different examples. The second one is something called situational self-control. This is a psychologist named Angela Duckworth. She's most famous for her work on grit. Grit is like the combination of passion about a topic and perseverance in seeking that topic. So you've got grit when you seek what you're passionate about with perseverance. But she's done lots of other work too. And one thing she's worked on is called situational self-control. Here's the idea. One practices situational self-control by, quote, intentionally choosing to be in situations that favor goal-oriented valuation systems over temptation-oriented valuation systems. That's a lot of big words. What's it mean? Well, I think of it like this. You have situational self-control when you intentionally choose situations that are more in line with your goal of the thing you want to grow in or do, and less in line with the temptation that you're facing. You see what I mean? If you're trying to quit drinking alcohol, for instance, you set yourself up for success by avoiding the places where you're sorely tempted to drink the alcohol. So you don't go to the bars. You know, if you've got a group of buddies that really lead you into temptation, have another one. You avoid those people, and that's a way of practicing self-control by controlling the situation that you're in. You avoid the occasions for sinful activity. Now, as Catholics, we've already got this notion. Right? The first time I started with Aquinas and then moved forward to the psychologists. Now I'm starting with the psychologists and moving backwards, so to speak, to Aquinas. We're not going to go all the way to him, though. We'll go to Alphonsus Liguori, who says this. He says, "As we not only avoid the bite of the serpent, but are careful neither to touch nor approach it, so we must fly not only from sin, but also from the occasion of sin. That is, from the house, the conversation, the person that would lead us to sin." End quote. Very many of you, I imagine, when you go to confession, say an act of contrition that includes a line about avoiding the near occasions of sin. And that's exactly what he's saying here. We have to avoid those near occasions of sin. And I take that to be what Duckworth was saying too. If you're tempted to, in the example I gave, drink too much alcohol, you avoid the near occasion of sin by using situational self-control. I love this picture, by the way. I love the way he's looking. Like, when I look at this picture, this is actually a real painting too, it's not AI. When I look at this picture, it strikes me as either someone playing a game with you, and he's like, no, wait, that's not what the rule says. Look in the rule book right here. Here's what you're not allowed to do that. Or I think he's just found the coupon in the coupon book that someone else told him wasn't there. And he goes, 10% off Subway right here. So I love that picture of him. All right, this also, the previous one was a real picture. You might guess this is not a real picture. This is also an AI picture. But the basic idea is just that you find in contemporary psychology and traditional moral wisdom from Christianity, you find these two things, fasting and situational self-control, taught in both. And it makes sense because they both seem useful. Sometimes the AI goes kind of haywire. So, like, what's going on here, right? That dude just snuck into that nunnery. And, you know, you probably don't put very many candles immediately behind your chair or your Bunsen or graduated cylinder, I guess. Who knows, the keyboard? They're still making it repays lots of attention, this one. Okay, that was the third thing I wanted to do. Talk about a couple different ways that contemporary psychology and Christian moral wisdom align with one another. Now the last thing I want to do, and like I said, it's going to be the most of what we do. I want to talk about growing in virtue. I want to talk about getting a little less awful. We've talked about what the virtues are. We've talked about how to distinguish different virtues. We've talked about how some routes to gaining virtue are found both in psychology and in Christian moral wisdom. Now let's talk about the concrete. How do you do it? Here's my buddy Aristotle. He says, "The purpose of our examination is not to know what virtue is, but to become good, since otherwise our inquiry would be of no benefit to us." What's the idea? Well, you could learn an awful lot about what virtue is and still be a scoundrel. Lots of ethical theorists count as knowing a lot about what virtue is and not living particularly virtuous lives. If I had to choose which one I'd rather you or my own children have, lots of knowledge of what the virtues are, but not much virtue, or lots of virtue and not much knowledge of what virtue is, I'd much rather them have the virtue than just have the knowledge about it. Of course, I'd rather them have both, but if I had to choose, I would go with them having the virtue. How do you get it? How do you become a little less awful? Well, I've got, easy for us, I've got 8 simple steps. Fly through it. Super easy. Start with this. Start with acquiring the target. No one just grows in virtue full stop. I'm going to grow in virtue. That never happens. You got to pick a thing you're going to try to grow in. What's the virtue you want to grow in? When I teach introduction to philosophy classes at St. Thomas, where I teach in the Twin Cities, In my class, we have the last 8 weeks of class, we do a virtue formation exercise where I have the students think about what sort of virtue they see in others that they want to see more in themselves, or what sort of vice they see in themselves that they don't like, that they want to eradicate in the hopes of growing in a virtue. And we go through these sorts of steps. In fact, a lot of this comes from some research I did for forming that sort of exercise. But I want you to think now, what's the virtue I want to grow in? You don't have to tell me, of course, but think of the thing you want to grow in. And I want you to have a concrete one in mind as we go through so that you can actually use it when you think, oh yeah, I can do it this way with that. So my students will often tell me they procrastinate too much. They want to cut down their sloth, increase their studiousness. They tell me that they're gluttonous in some way or other, eating way too much in the dining hall, drinking too much alcohol. They tell me that they're ungrateful to people who have loved them and served them well. Like, look what their parents did to get them to college, all the things they did to get them there, the money they're paying now for them to go to college. And they've been generally ungrateful to their parents for this. Students are not meek. I'm not saying all students are unmeek, but I'm saying some of my students have said, look, I've got serious road rage. It's going to get me shot one day. I'd like to get rid of that road rage. That's trying to get rid of your wrath and grow in meekness. You can pick whichever one you want, but try to think of something now that you want to try to grow in. How do you figure out what to grow in? Well, you got to acquire the target, the what. So here's this, surprisingly enough, isn't AI. This is from Wikipedia. It's an old image of an examination of conscience. So think of how do you tell. One thing you might do is perform an examination of conscience. Pray, how do I get better? Pray, what am I failing at? Ask the Lord. A second thing you might do, besides by yourself trying to figure it out with the Lord, is ask someone who loves you. Ask someone who knows you well and loves you what he or she thinks you can grow in. AI doesn't always get it right, you can tell. If you say image of a husband asking his wife for vices that he has and the husband has a beard, well, you know, they can't always win, the AI. So that picture's not so hot. This, like, what's going on here? But you might ask people closest to you. I asked my wife once. I said, beloved wife, I would like you to tell me the three things you think I should work on most to try to grow in virtue. And before you think this is a setup so I can give you three afterwards, you can ignore what you say and be like, do this and this and this. We won't talk about your, ever have to talk about anything about you, but at least tonight, we won't talk about yours. Just you give me some that you think I should grow on. And she very kindly did. And my three and her three, there was no overlap. The three things I thought I had to grow in most weren't the three that she thought I had to grow in most. I'm not going to tell any of you scoundrels any of them. But those six things, I was like, jeepers, I thought I knew me. She sees me even when I'm not looking, so to speak. You know, she sees me when I'm not really reflecting on myself, and she thinks it's a different set of problems. So how do you acquire the target? You might ask those closest to you. This picture didn't work, so I tried another one. This was, I just said, give me a husband with a beard, ask his wife for a list of his major flaws. I asked again, and I got this picture. I didn't doctor it at all. Just asked the same thing, and you get this poor guy, surprised, just wanted to play on his phone, and a wife with a huge scroll that's seemingly empty. Like, there's nothing's on that scroll, just lines. And then I thought to myself, this seems gendered. I wonder if I switch husband and wife and cut out the word beard, because I don't want this sort of fiasco again. Switch husband and wife, what would the image look like then? Well, you're welcome. I did. And it looked like this. This is when a wife asks her husband for the three things that she needs to grow on. Look at this little thing he has, and look how scared he looks. Of course, this is just AI. Don't take a picture of this one. yeah, this is just AI. It's a funny gendered difference that you find in ChatGPT, not ChatGPT, in Bing, I guess. All right, final thing on this point. How many targets? How many targets should you try to acquire? Some people think, I'll do all of them. Now I'm on fire to grow in virtue. I want to be virtuous. Your wife says you got these three. You pray with the Lord, you get these three. Just do all six, you big wimp. Why don't you just do all six? Well, it's because I'm not strong enough to do all six, and I doubt you are either. St. Ignatius of Loyola, when he thinks about this, he wasn't thinking about you personally, didn't really know you, but he's thinking about how many to try to grow in. And he says this, even if there are several main vices in someone, it is still advantageous to choose one of them, which to fight to the full. Only when it has been overcome do we move on to another, and then another yet, and focus our efforts and attention on it. So what's Ignatius say? Ignatius, a great moral master. What's he say? Don't try them all at once. It's exhausting. Find one, kick its butt, go to the next one, kick its butt. You find the same thing too from Lorenzo Scopoli, who wrote a really wonderful work called The Spiritual Warfare. In it, he says, quote, if you desire to attain solid virtue and complete mastery over self, dividing the exercise of different virtues so as to assign particular virtues to particular days is to be avoided, resulting as it does in a state of perpetual vicissitude. What a cool phrase. I'll come back to it in a sec. Do not aim at all sorts of virtue or even many simultaneously, but cultivate one firmly, then another, if you wish such habits to take deep roots in your soul with greater facility. What's the idea here? Well, it's this. If you say, like, Mondays are for gluttony, I'm going to fight it Mondays, and Tuesdays are for fighting my envy, and for Wednesdays, or maybe I'm trying to grow in charity, he says what you're going to result in there is not a strong, deeply rooted virtue. Perpetual means always, and vicissitude means change. So it's always changing, is the idea. So he too thinks, find one, do it well. A third example, a bit outside of Christian moral wisdom, is Ron Swanson. You might have heard of him from Parks and Recreation. Ron Swanson says, never half-ass two things, whole-ass one thing. And I think St. Ignatius of Loyola didn't speak English, but he probably said something just like that in Italian. So that's him. We had two saints and then Ron Swanson. Maybe, who knows? All right, the second of our eight steps. Motivational clarity on why. You've got the thing you want to grow in. Look, I'm super envious. I look at these Facebook, that's, I'm so old. What do you guys do? Insta-twit, gram it up. Be Real, is Be Real still a thing? I was thinking like two years ago, Be Real was so cool, you guys. And I was with it for a sec. You guys even know what Be Real is? Yeah, a couple of you are like cringing. Yeah, okay, good. While we're at it, let me just get one of these out of the way. Boom, there we go. Like, pro tip, when you have children, just keep one of those locked and loaded, ready to go in a moment's notice, in a store, anywhere you go. All right, I digress. The why. Why, okay. So you got the what, you know what you want to grow in, but you know what? It's not always like a honeymoon. You get tired of trying to grow. You just got through Lent, right? You got to week one, you're like, I'm kicking butt. And week four came and you're like, this is stupid. Everything is stupid. I don't want to do this stupid thing anymore. I was an idiot for choosing this thing. Well, no, you weren't. You weren't dumb for choosing this thing. It was good to choose giving up chocolate and gossiping whatever it is that you gave up. What you need to do is get clear on the why. It wasn't stupid. You're just tired or you're just hungry. Getting clear on the why helps you in those times when your other motivations dip, when you're sick of fasting. Remind yourself why you want to grow in this thing. I want to grow in gratitude because my parents deserve it, or because it makes my relationship with them more deep and fulfilling for them and for me, or because it models gratitude to them so my younger siblings can see what it looks like to be a decent child to parents. And then they can be better. I want to love my younger sibling to be better. Or it makes me shameful when I see myself acting in this manner. So think of the reasons why you want to grow in this virtue. You can write them down. Just keep them mindful so that later when you're like grumpy about it, you can remember what it was that made you want to do this in the first place. Okay, number three. Consider your situations. That was the third thing on my list there. You've got the what you're going to try to fight. You've got the why you want to fight it. Now consider when this thing arises. This is the situational self-control part. I really want to stop gossiping. I do it with my friends. I feel really bad about it. Afterwards, someone else will find out about it. And then I look like a total jerk, rightfully so, because I was talking trash behind their back. I hate the fact that we gossip so much. It's unhealthy for us and for our friendships. When do I do it? Well, we mostly do it on the WhatsApp chat thread that we have. WhatsApp, you guys use WhatsApp, right? You've heard of the WhatsApp? You got it? So I use it primarily on that. Maybe I can just mute that conversation for a while. Or I hate how envious I feel. Then I go on social media and I see all these people living these wonderful, glamorous lives and going on vacations. And I freaking hate those people. And I don't want them to have enjoyment. And it makes me so grumpy and angry. Well, the best thing to do there is to avoid the thing that's making you sit bitter and poisoned in yourself. So consider your situations and try to figure out ways that you can avoid the most dangerous things to this particular virtue you're trying to grow. If you're trying to avoid envy, try to cull your life of the things that call forth envy from you. That's what this guy's doing. He's resisting temptation. He's driving right past the place called Bar, and he's sweating because he's trying so hard. But he knows if he goes in, it's going to be a big problem. So you can ask yourself, if you're not really avoiding, but you're growing, what can you do? Here's what I mean. You know, if you're feeling a lot of envy, like I said, you can get off Instagram for a while, and maybe that will curtail some of the envy. If I'm feeling a lot of impatience, which I do with some frequency, if I'm feeling a lot of impatience, I can't just avoid my children. My children are a main cause of impatience in my life. I can't. My wife and the law both frown upon me avoiding my children like that. So I can't just log out of dadding for a while. I'm stuck with it now. I made my bed, now I got a line, I got all these kids, got to dad them real good. That makes sense. But I can't just avoid them. What can I do then? Well, here are four things contemporary psychologists talk about when they talk about growing a virtue. One is called piggybacking. You piggyback when you add a practice to an already existing habit. You know this sort of thing already. You have to take an antibiotic for 10 days because you've got an infection and you keep forgetting to do it. If you put it right next to your toothbrush, and if you're not gross, you'll remember to do it each day because every day when you brush your teeth, it's right there. So it's piggybacking to add it to something you're already habituated to do. How to do that with virtue? Well, suppose you're trying to grow more in your prayer life. And you know every morning you have a cup of coffee. Maybe you put your Bible right next to your cup so that in the morning, it's right there for you. It's waiting for you. You piggyback it. How about swapping? You can switch out one routine for another routine on an existing cue. Here's what I mean. Suppose you're trying to grow in temperance, trying to be less gluttonous. And after dinner, you know that you've got a hankering for something sweet to eat. That's just going to be there. It's a stable routine in your life. You might switch out the sugary desserts that you want to have with like an apple. Now it sounds good in the abstract. If you try it tomorrow, you'd be like, that's stupid, professor. This is dumb. I hate that guy. But you can switch it out is the idea. You can swap out knowing that the routine will still be there. You'll still have this desire for it. You can try to switch out the things you use for it. A third is adding friction. Make it harder for you to do the thing that you don't want to do. So if the thing you don't want to do involves your phone, like looking at Instagram or whatever it is you're looking at, you might put your phone in the family room. Leave it there. If, you know, your younger siblings aren't going to like do trolly things with it. But leave it elsewhere. If it's a computer that's causing problems, can you put it in the communal room? So you might make it harder to do the thing that's leading you astray. Muting the conversation on WhatsApp was an example of adding friction because it's not like you can't respond. It just becomes harder to respond because you're not going to see it as often. And the opposite of friction is a driving force. It's adding something that makes it easier to perform the activity. So the example they typically use is if you want to run in the mornings, when you wake up, have everything laid out so that you're ready to go right away. You don't have to go trolling through your drawers in the dark. You just have it all sitting there ready to go. And it makes it easier to get going in the morning. So likewise with prayer. If what you're trying to do is grow in your prayer life, have it all ready to go. Know what you want to read. Know what you want to pray about. Don't get up early and then stare at your bookshelf trying to figure out what it is you're going to read for prayer. Have a habit formed by having things set out already for you. Okay. There's something called implementation intentions. This is a thing for controlling your situations. And the basic idea here is you think to yourself, when this arises, I'll do that. When situation X arises, I will perform response Y. Have it formed already in your mind. What's the thing you want to grow in? Suppose you want to grow in drinking less alcohol, growing in your temperance. In that case, if you know that game day is always a hard day because your friends want to start drinking at 9 in the morning because they're maniacs, you might make a rule for yourself already, whatever that rule might be. And then you don't have to make the rule up on the fly in the moment. If your rule is something like no more than 3 drinks in the day, well, that's not a rule you're going to make when you have 3 drinks. You're already like 3 drinks deep, and then you're going to be like, oh, I'll be reasonable now and make a good and prudent rule for safeguarding my morality. No, you won't. Or don't wait till you're angry. If you're going to Thanksgiving dinner with your uncle and he always drives you bonkers with the things he says, you don't wait until you're like flipping out angry at him to make a rule. Oh yes, now I'm calm and collected. I'll make a rule about what to... No, that's a terrible time to do it. You make the rule beforehand, and then you live according to the rule when you're all fired up and angry, or when you're all tipsy. You live according to the rule. So make the rule first is the idea here. Okay, another thing to do. We've figured out what we want to grow in. We've figured out our motivations for it. We've considered our situations and how to control those situations to maximize the likelihood that we do it well. We can also work in a community. After all, it's the body of Christ. We're together in this. So you might work with a spiritual director. Maybe you have one already. You might say, Father, help me with this. Here's what I'm suffering with. And then Father will hold you accountable. You might make a plan and tell it to your friends. Guys, keep me honest. I want to grow in not swearing as much. I want more control over my tongue. St. James talks about this in Scripture, right? I want more control over my tongue. Okay, fair enough. We'll help you out, buddy. And then they jingle the swear jar. You know, like whenever you're watching the game and you say all those words that your mother doesn't want to hear you say, and then they say, ah, you did it again, didn't you? And then you got to pay up to the swear jar. But you can form a plan with buddies to help you. Or you might just like promise to somebody. You know, if again, I keep going back to alcohol because that is, you guys have heard of alcohol, right? Sometimes on college campuses it comes up a little bit. But if someone is worried about you drinking too much, she knows you're going to an open bar at the wedding, and she's like, oh gosh, I remember what happened last time this person went to an open bar. You might promise the person, you might interpersonally commit. And such a commitment can help you. Like even when you're feeling the throes and temptations, having committed and promised to somebody you love is a strong motivator. And if it doesn't motivate you, if the fact that you promised to somebody you love not to do this thing doesn't motivate you, that's good evidence for you about the state of your character. So work in your community. Finally, with the community, we've got such a great gift as Catholics, or at least this is the Thomistic Institute. I'm assuming there's Catholics in the room. We've got such a great gift of exemplars in the church. We've got someone who's really good at this thing, someone who's really good at that thing. We've got them there. We can look up to them, and we can try to live like they lived. How did he do that thing? Well, oftentimes we have biographies of the saints. Look it up. See how he did it. Try to act likewise. All right. The next thing I talked about was SMART goals. And so you might have heard of these before. This isn't something I made up. But when you're making a goal, you think to yourself, okay, here's what I want to grow in. How am I going to do it? You want a specific goal? Don't be like, I'm not going to envy. Yeah, good luck. Like, how are you going to measure that one? You want a specific goal. You want it to be something you can measure. Number of beverages, time you waste on your phone that you should be doing work. You can look that up in your screen time. You want it to be actually attainable for you. Something that's not so hard it's going to lead you to depression or angst because you just can't do it. It's got to be really something you can do on your own. It's got to be relevant to the thing you're trying to do. If you're trying to grow in temperance, the activity you perform should be something that's relevant to the sort of temperance you want to grow in, like avoiding dessert 3 times a week if you're trying to grow in temperance with respect to food. And make it time-bound. Don't say, forevermore, my whole life, I will do this thing. That's taking on way too much. Start with like 2 weeks. You can do anything for 2 weeks, right? You can like not eat dessert for 2 weeks. Start with 2 weeks. Start with 2 days, but start with something that's time-bound and manageable for yourself. But this way, when you commit to it, you've got it like in black and white, right? 3 times a week, I'm going to not have dessert. And if I can't pull that off, well, I mean, I shouldn't feel shame about it, but that's good intel for me to have about my ability to live temperately. Okay, just three more things. One thing I want to do is utilize reward. Here's a fact about our psychology. We don't form habits unless the activity is in some way rewarding, either positively, because it gives you some benefit, or negatively, because it withholds or fends off some detriment. So if you don't have some sort of benefit there, some sort of reward there for yourself, it's not going to become second nature for you to keep acting that way. So to cultivate a virtue, you're going to need some sort of reward there for it. Now, it's true, virtue is its own reward. That makes sense. Like the person who's got his urges really under control has an easier life in a lot of ways than a person who's got his urges not under control at all. But still, it works best when you have some sort of reward built into it. And don't make that reward contrary to the thing you're trying to grow in. If you're trying to quit drinking so much alcohol, don't say, look, I'll abstain for 6 days, and then I'll have a cheat day on day 7 where I can drink as much as I want to. That's never going to help you form a habit of being temperate with respect to alcohol. Don't say, like, if you're trying to spend less money, don't say, if I do it good for a week, I'll have a cheat day with money, with spending a bunch of money. The thought then is this: make the reward something that doesn't contradict the very thing you're trying to grow in. But there's a warning here. Whenever it is a good thing, you want to make sure that you love the giver of the gift and not just merely the gift that's given. So the idea here is this: you don't want to just love God because God gives you all these baubles and pleasurable things. You want to love God for who God is. Even if God didn't give you the good things, you think you should still love him. Job said, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And he said that in his throes. So you got to make sure that you don't just love the reward, but you love the reward giver. All right, and the last two are both visualizations. First thing I want you to think about is this. I want you to visualize what success looks like. If I were to do this thing this whole week well, what would it look like? If I'm trying to grow in my perseverance in my studies and not be so procrastinating with social media, what would an excellent week look like? Well, I'd spend 2 hours a day, or however long. I'll spend an hour a day in the library doing my work. I'll leave my phone in my room. I can live without a phone for an hour, right? I could do that. Or if I can't do that, I'll power it off so I have some friction so I don't just get sucked back into it. I'll make sure I have a list and I'll check off the things on my list. When Bill says, hey, you want to go for Thirsty Thursdays to the bar? I'll say no because I have to do this thing on Friday. You guys have Thirsty Thursdays here?
You heard?
I feel like college students, just for every day of the week, there's some like Whiskey Wednesday and Get Drunk Tuesday. I don't know, I didn't have a T word Tuesday. But I feel like there's more and more of these things. Anyway, the point though is just this. Make a plan, visualize what excellence will look like for yourself. And then do it the opposite way. Visualize failure. Man, I've got a good plan. What are the ways I might goof it up? What are two ways that would be a problem? Bill comes in and he's there with a couple other dudes and he's giving me a hard time. Maybe he's making fun of me a little bit. Come on, you big wimp. What are you going to do? Some homework? What a dork. Blah, blah, blah. You already got a C minus. That's enough for getting your blah, 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 blah. What am I going to do when that happens? Make a plan now about that sort of thing. So you want to visualize failure, visualize main routes to failure, and then safeguard against them. That's the plan here. Okay, how about after you're tempted? You feel a strong urge to act in the way you're trying hard not to act. Well, did you succeed? If you succeeded, bring that to the Lord in prayer, in thanksgiving. Look, God, I had this hard thing come up. By your grace, I was able to avoid it. Thanks be to God, and thanks be to you. Did you fail? Well, bring that to God in penitential prayer. Lord, I know I can't make it ever without your help. I know you're helping me. I've fallen again. St. Francis de Sales has these beautiful prayers where it's basically like a child after he's fallen and broken something, going back not in fear that dad's going to hit him, but in love and sadness. Ah, oh, I screwed it up again, dad. And then the father collects him in and gives him a hug. Think of God like that. He's not going to kick you when you're down. He wants you to grow in love with him. So bring it to the Lord even when you fail. Don't let the shame get in the way. of bringing it back to the Lord. So then finally, those were the eight I said we should do to try to get a little less awful. We should think about what our target is, why we're motivated to grow in that target, the situations we're in, the community we work in, what kind of goal we should form, what kind of rewards we should build in, and we should visualize what success and failure looks like. And so that's what we've done. We've talked about what virtue is. We saw that quotation from Aquinas about it. We talked about the different types or divisions among the virtues based on what they're aimed at. We talked about some general agreement between psychology and Christian moral wisdom about fasting and about situational self-control or avoiding the near occasion of sin. And then we talked about those eight different ways you might go about trying to become just a little less awful. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.